Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our exploration of the many domains of consciousness here on the show. I'm happy to announce that soon this fall I will come out with another book. This one is a collection called Nomad Codes, Adventures in Modern Esoterica, and it collects my best essays, profiles, metaphysical speculations, cultural criticisms, etc., over the last couple of decades. But we faced an interesting challenge when me and the publisher, Yeti Books, who come out with the wonderful Yeti Journal along with a number of marvelous books, were talking about the cover. You know, the cover's a big deal when you're putting out a book. And it's hard to figure out exactly how to get an appropriate cover for a book that collects lots of very different kinds of things, from like rock reviews to, you know, mystical speculations and discussions of the internet, entrepreneurs and UFOs. You know, it's a wide range of stuff that I cover in the book, and I was very happy that we were able to get an image from our guest today, Fred Tomaselli, for the cover of the book, because Fred's work, for me, is one of my definitely favorite contemporary artists, and certainly one of my favorite artists who has achieved, official art world success, who really deals with the kinds of currents of psychedelia, of esoteric longings, of utopianism, of a love for the natural world, and yet does it in a way that's very contemporary, edgy, and very material, very much involved with the world of materials that we actually live in, rather than just the world of ideas and dreams and visions, which so compels us. And for those of you who are not familiar with his work, you might as well get online and just do a little Fred Tomaselli image search right there, and you'll get a sense of what's going on there. Just to talk a little bit more about his stuff, for those of you who don't know, he brings together collage and painting effects, drawing in lots of different kinds of objects in terms, including like actual plants, which he grows in his garden and which have included in the past, not in his garden, but just on the painting, marijuana leaves, as well as actual pills, pharmaceuticals, and paint, and photos, and images, and drawings, and then puts them together in these marvelous objects, which are then covered with a transparent resin. So they have this mysterious shine that brings all of these crazy objects and images together in a very powerful, playful, sometimes frightening, sometimes maddening, but consistently marvelous way. And he's just... show is just open, a mid-career survey, as they put it, at the Brooklyn Museum. So if you guys are listening from the Northeast or the greater metropolitan area, get to the Brooklyn Museum to check out his show. It'll be there through January 2nd. Maja will not be joining us today, so let's just get right to it and welcome Fred Tomaselli to Expanding Mind. Hey, Fred.
Hi, Eric. Hey, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So you're in the midst of moving your studio, which you've been in for 20 years there in Brooklyn.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think that's Verizon. I'm really sorry. Can I just tell them to come up and install my phone line?
Absolutely. We like interruptions here. It reminds us of what the world's about.
Okay, the world is bad. Hold on a second.
So just to say a little bit more about Fred's work, is one of the things that's interesting about it is that he draws quite explicitly from... Oh, that was quick. I was just giving a little bit more...
I didn't know how to answer it, so fuck it. I'm sorry.
That's the spirit.
It's a really, really crazy day. Sorry, Eric. I'm moving my studio from 20 years in Williamsburg to Bushwick, and it's just completely insane.
Can I ask why? What would compel you to do such a torturous activity? I can only imagine the amount of stuff, especially being, working with collage as you do, how much materials you have, let alone 20 years of pop culture fandom and book collecting and all that other stuff.
Yeah, it's a huge archive. The archive got so big that I got crowded out and there wasn't any room to make art anymore. So a friend of mine... oh, God, I think I just lost Verizon. So what? Okay. I couldn't work anymore, and so a friend of mine found a place and told me about it, and, here I am in Bushwick. And it's only about a mile and a half from my house because I still live in Williamsburg, so it's perfect. And it's kind of great over here.
When did you move to Brooklyn from Southern California?
1985, 25 years ago this month.
All right. Well, yeah. I'd love to go back there. I always like to ask people kind of where they come from, what the background is, and one of the things that I really like about your work is there is a certain, to me anyway, as a Southern Californian, a Southern California vibe to some of it, and I know that you're interesting and in some ways, aggressively banal and in other ways aggressively hip. Experience in Southern California is really important to the artist that you became. So if you could talk a little bit about like where you grew up or like where you went to high school. Was it like Ridgemont High? Was it that kind of scene?
Well, I mostly grew up in Santa Ana and Northern Orange County. And the sort of like theme park culture was close by in Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm and all that. And there was also the emerging mall culture. And, a lot of us surfed and were into rock and roll and drugs. And I think the amalgamation of this sort of like the sort of Southern California landscape of the unreal mixed with what was going on generally in culture sort of conspired to dislocate my sense of reality in a way that I eventually put into my work.
What was your experience of Disneyland when you were a kid? I mean, was it the most magical place you could possibly imagine? Did you go there? What was your experience of it?
Well, in the working class community that I grew up in, there were a lot of tickets that were floating around from Boeing night or McDonnell Douglas night. And, we could basically just go there whenever we wanted. And, I don't recall ever really loving it. I recall like trying to get away with stuff and then getting busted by like a cop dressed as a Keystone cop or something, and it was basically, it was pretty apparent early on that it was a highly controlled, I don't want to use this term too broadly, but, it's basically a fascist-controlled happy state, happy police state. And so I kind of grew to fear it a little bit. That being said, there were these sort of, like, uncanny, things that would happen, like every night at 9 o'clock, Tinkerbell would fly through the night sky amid the bursting fireworks. And I thought that was normal. I didn't realize that not everybody kind of, like, had that in their backyard. So,
yeah, it's funny how early you can get the sense that something's wrong here. I mean, it's funny they did those aerospace nights. I went there one time with my friend whose father worked at General Dynamics, which was another one of these big, defense contracting corporations that would rent it out for the night. And it was really a blast as a kid because you could just run around. There weren't any lines or whatever. But even then, there was something sort of unpleasant about it. But I always loved Pirates of the Caribbean. Never had a problem. I had a problem with that. That almost was a map of a future visionary states that one would go into. I mean, it's fascinating the way that even in this highly controlled, highly cheesy, highly middle America situation, that there's still this reference to the visionary. There's still this attempt to capture and even satisfy the kinds of desires for vision that also lead people into drug culture and into spirituality and who respond to some of that material in your stuff. But it's there even in the corporate monster.
No. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned the corporate monster, because even though a lot of the juice for my work does come out of the esoterica that springs from the counterculture of Southern California, when I was first started making my work, Ronald Reagan, was president, and basically he was another California product, I might add. And, he was an actor, to my mind, portraying a president. And there was this, there was this sort of general, sort of happy talk world that was coming out of corporate America that was equally reality compromised, shall we say, to the kind of, to whatever was going on with the acid culture. So, I mean, you had this sort of corporate culture of like Disneyland and Ronald Reagan and corporate America, and then you had this other thing going on. I think they both kind of collided in my head to make me the person I am today.
and you were part of the music scene. Were you like SST or like punk rock, new wave? What was your experience there?
I kind of grew up, like going to a lot of stoner rock and glam rock shows. And then October 1978, I saw the Germs. And prior to that, I'd seen the Stooges and whatnot, but it was like there was a kind of a key moment for me. I just sort of like, because I wasn't a good hippie, I think I was maybe a little too wired and a little too angry, and everybody was in the process of mellowing out. It just really, that music and the scene around the, I guess, Hollywood punk rock scene really seemed to agree with my metabolism at the time. So I went with that until I came to New York in 85. And although I still really like punk rock.
Sure, sure. who wouldn't? Like, so what, did you like move? Did you have the intention of becoming a famous artist, or did you just decide you wanted to go to New York?
It's a funny, circuitous sort of road to where I ended up. I mean, I kind of thought that the art world was way too bourgeois for me, and I was pretty itchy and angry, and so I put out fanzines and music magazines, or collaborated with other fanzines and music magazines up until about 1982, I was very much involved with the music scene and very much going out all the time and getting high all the time. And there was this part of me that really didn't wanna, that couldn't not make stuff. I've always been like in the garage making things and inventing things. And eventually my need to make stuff sort of overwhelmed my other issues I had around the kind of bourgeois and sort of the problems I had with the art world, so to speak. So I basically started making installations that were modeled on theme parks. And, I would try to deliver an escapist experience to the viewer while, commenting on the mechanics of escapism in this culture. And that eventually led to the pictures I make now.
Well, let's talk about that dynamic a little bit, because it's something that I'm totally fascinated with, and that I often find myself gravitating towards, is that back and forth, almost like that there's some really deep and very authentic part of ourselves that craves a vision, that craves wonder, that wants enchantment. And it's not just like a childhood thing. It's something very profound about where our hearts lie, where possibility lies, where we see ourselves woven into nature. Often it's through nature that we have this sense of another world opening up. And yet in our world, you can't be naive about that desire. It's packaged and sold back to us. And in fact, it seems like you know, that you have to be kind of critical of that process, how it comes to us, how we want it ourselves. But if you're too critical about it, that you lose something. So there's something, it's too pessimistic, it's too dark, it's too empty. So there's some balance between those two of experiencing the wonder and then kind of cracking it open. And that seems to me that dynamic is something that's really important to you in your work, particularly how it affects people, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I guess initially, you know, a lot of my work came out of doubt and came out of a whole lot of issues I had with the culture and with the art world and also with just pictures and artworks in general. So I think my initial premise was to kind of question the whole thing and try to make work that could sort of, I don't know, survive in a way like outside of the marketplace and outside of these things that I was really, really critical of. But as I said before, you know, there was this other need within me that was kind of circumventing this more intellectual side of me. And so that as those works that I started initially making that sort of dealt with the doubt, what happened was that more and more, the initial work I think was like more or less illustrations of conceptual ideas I had about pictures and the mechanics of pictures and how pictures can rearrange reality in the viewer, how they can alter perception. And then eventually, once I had gotten done saying that, I just started putting a little bit more and more of the things that I really loved into the work. And eventually, I think it was, you know, initially I was putting pills into pictures to sort of rearrange their use value. Instead of traveling normally through the bloodstream to affect consciousness, they traveled through the eyeballs. So it's a different route to the brain, a different way of modifying reality in the viewer. But when I started adding pot leaves into the work, what I eventually found was I was adding the shape of nature. And shortly thereafter, a whole flood of nature imagery started flooding into the, started coming into the work. And, you know, I'd always had this relationship with nature that was pretty profound and really real, you know, but I think maybe I was repressing it. And it was, I think through pot was the gateway that allowed me to kind of put that shape back into the work, and the work has been moving in that direction ever since.
Well, that's wonderful. I love the organicism of what you're talking about. It's always struck me the connection between pot in particular and nature or feel for nature. Even like if you look at the way that you know, kids growing up, the way that they'll smoke pot, they'll get together with their friends or whatever, and okay, they're dealing with a material. Maybe they even try to grow it. So it's already, they have some relationship with some growing thing that they might not otherwise do. But then it's also like, it always leads you somewhere. It's like, it takes you to that weird culvert where like there's all those bushes or that one area at the edge of the suburb or the beach or some place that's kind of like, if not natural, you know, official nature, like quasi nature, and there's a way in which it kind of right. like seduces into seeing pattern and kind of appreciating texture in a way that always seemed to really highlight that kind of portal. And it sounds to me from what you're saying that it wasn't like an intentional move, like I'm going to make art that has more positive feelings in it or whatever. It was like you were just sort of following the material in a way, and the material led you into places because some of your work has none of that, you know, punk rock skepticism or politically charged awareness of how screwed up our reality is, which is true in other things that you've done. Mm-hmm. But some of it is just gloriously, juicily transcendent, while also being very embodied.
Well, yeah, I mean, you kind of make me think of a few things. I mean, you know, first of all, like, I make these hybrid works that are amalgamations of photographs and paint and real things. And often there's this hybridity of ideologies, some of which are antithetical to one another. But I'm also a hybrid person insofar as that I've been inexorably altered by drugs and by media and by this culture that I've grown up in. And, you know, the shape of nature, the way it's imprinted on me, got imprinted in a pretty psychedelic way, I think, in some key moments of my life. I mean, certainly with acid and with psilocybin, and sort of a more kind of, prosaic relationship with pot. You know, pot doesn't just kind of connect you with the kind of the vibes of nature, but like as you were saying, it leads you back into the garden. It leads you back into an actual relationship with plants. And for me, when I was growing pot, and say in Fullerton, I also had to grow tomatoes to sort of disguise the crop. And then I sort of started getting into tomatoes too, you know. And before I knew it, I was this sort of like I was gardening. I was just a general gardener. And I tend to look at my work in terms of like they are in fact gardens, or that they're managed nature. I mean, I've taken all these leaves and the shape of nature and pictures that come out of nature, and I arrange them and weed them out and cultivate them and turn them into art. So I think that relationship between the garden, between pot and these other ideas that I had that were, I guess more conceptual, all kind of blended together to turn into the kind of work I'm making now.
Is there a particular natural landscape or experience in nature that really stays with you as a sense of that deeper power?
Well, you know, I mean, I think a lot of the kind of like the lodestar kind of places are the places I used to escape to when I was growing up in Southern California. So that would be the, you know, the foothill country, you know, up around Cleveland National Forest, the sort of oak woodland canyons, but also on the other side out in Joshua Tree, and that sort of desert sublime, and the whole western sublime, you know, the Sierras, and the ocean as well, like all those things I think were key places in my relationship and development of the kind of ideal I have about nature. And it's still the place I go to for the super nature head rush that I need at least a couple of times a year. So I have to get on a plane and get out there every now and then just to be in it, you know.
Yeah, I'm not living in the West Coast right at the moment.
I miss it bad.
I could feel the nature call.
Like,
but it's also interesting is that you talk about the garden and you're a gardener and you that's an important part of your life as well. And that's a side of nature that I think people don't. I mean, they increasingly are talking about it. I mean, there's really a renewal of gardening culture, especially in the alternative scene and younger people and people aware who just want to get back to something real, but who also are inspired by the productivity of nature and getting away from screens and such. But because that's something that you do that's part of your life in a strong way, right?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, a lot of the plants that I grow and that end up in my work come out of the garden, and they have to be picked while they're alive and then pressed into plant presses and then cataloged. So it's very, it comes out of necessity and it also comes out of desire. But, you know, I'd like to say that, like, you know, my relationship to landscape is also kind of a culturally modified relationship. I mean, the first time I ever saw you, I lived in Yosemite for a year, which was a pretty amazing experience. But I remember the first time I kind of came through the tunnel and hit Artist Point, and I had the oh wow, Hosanna, sublime Kantian moment when I was looking at the vista, but I was also looking at it through a scrim of Ansel Adams photographs and Muybridge photographs and all these sort of nature films that I had seen. And so for me, you know, even what we consider to be wild landscape is sort of been modified either physically or ideologically or through representations by man, by culture. So I tend to see like even the wildest places on earth as having a kind of relationship, a cultural relationship. And I think maybe sometimes in my own work, I explore that cultural relationship to nature. And I don't want to say that I feel like it's a diminished relation. It doesn't diminish my love of it. It's just, I'm trying to be real about what it is. I'm trying to maybe do the sort of modern equivalent of, I'm trying to be like Frederick Church, but with, you know, but I'd already, but with having seen all these documentaries and read all these and seen it on TV prior. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
Sense. I always feel that is that's one of the, I think that's one of the legacies of an awake Californian, is that you grow up in California, you know, and from the, you know, from the 19th century in terms of Euro-American culture, California was always nature. It was about nature, and it was, you know, it's incredibly beautiful. There's these sublime vistas, all sorts of different kinds of nature, mountain, desert, weird trees,
all,
incredible
baby.
Ocean, blah, blah, blah. And you grow up, and there's no way for this not to be part of your background. And at the same time, California is also, you know, sort of ground zero of the simulacrum, or ground zero of the theme park, fast food, mediated, you know, stuff. Like you talk about Moybridge or Ansel Adams, and they're Californian. They're spending a lot of time there. You know, San Francisco is the most photographed city in the 19th century because there's something about mediation and technological production that's also part of that legacy of California. So for me, the deep kind of visionary sort of wisdom or download of California is precisely that mutual reality, that it's not – that it is mediated, but that doesn't mean it's not part of the sublime as well, because, of course, media itself is part of the sublime and part of the one of those things that takes us to special places. So, yeah, you make perfect sense to me.
Well, you know, I mean, it's funny. I mean, if you grow up in a place, you can't really understand. I don't know if you can really understand a place you've grown up with if it's so familiar that if you don't have anything else to compare it to, it's just the way things are. And for me, I think even though I was wrestling with a lot of the issues that I'm talking about now while I was living in LA, it didn't really become clear. It didn't become clear to me until I moved to Brooklyn what it was about California that made it different and special and strange, you know, compared to the rest of the world. So I actually really needed to remove myself from California in order to understand California. And so in that regard, Brooklyn has, in a funny way, brought me closer to the ideas that were germinating there throughout my life.
No, I think it's a really good point. I mean, it was very true in my life as well. I went to school on the East Coast, and then I stayed in New York for 6 years. So I was on the East Coast for 10 years, and I became a very different person because I was a young man. I became much more intellectual and more critical. Mm-hmm. I was really into,
right,
you know, being a media critic, and a lot of my sort of really wild and wonderful and post-hippie upbringing in Southern California kind of went by the wayside, except that gradually the things I was writing about and thinking about became more in sync with that. And when I returned to California and moving to the Bay Area in the mid 90s, it was kind of like bringing these two parts of me together. And so now I feel like a thoroughly bi-coastal being. And I think that's a familiar experience that I've talked to other people about the other way as well. I mean, there's definitely the phenomenon of like the hyper intellectual kind of neurotic New Yorker who like moves to LA for a while and like becomes a different, you know, starts doing yoga, and then they're all kind of mellow, but they're not really mellow. And
no,
then
they
go back.
Really,
I mean, it's
mellow,
a wonderful dynamic.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, being here, I mean, I've also been able to plug in to this sort of, you know, the scene that came out of the you know, lower Manhattan beat scene, and very much involved with like the legacy of Harry Smith and Allen Ginsberg. And even though, I mean, obviously they both are, you know, people that freely floated between West and East Coast. I mean, it was the Lower East Side that where a lot of that scene sort of bloomed and blossomed. And so for me to be in the here is not entirely outside of the kind of cultural influences that have formed the kind of person I am. I'm really glad to have gotten to be more of a part of this sort of East Coast post-beat scene that's here in New York. And so that's also been really good for me as well.
Well, great. Well, we have a lot more things to talk about, but we're going to take a break here. This is Eric Davis.
Sure.
You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Peter Roth, the host of Energy Stew, which airs on Thursday nights at 8 p.m. My show interviews fascinating authors, inventors, and researchers of new understandings, techniques, and discoveries that can enhance and transform our lives. What is our potential and how can we fulfill it to the max? To find out, tune in to Energy Stew and Peter Roth at 8 p.m. Thursdays on Progressive Radio Network.
You're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
To PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis, and we're talking with Fred Tomaselli, who has a show up as we speak at the Brooklyn Museum through January. Fred, I wanted to ask you about your relationship to archives and objects. I mean, there's something very different about, one, just doing a collage where you're taking pieces of the world as photographs out of other sources or Xeroxing or copying or whatever, but even more to putting actual objects into the painting. It's a very different space than just, you know, using oils or whatever. What's that? What's that about for you? What is it? Is it about a relationship to material objects? Is it because you're an inveterate collector? I mean, what does that bring into your work that you like?
Well, initially, you know, I think I was referring earlier to like I wanted to make pictures that more or less dealt with the pre-modernist ideal of pictures as windows to other realities. And this idea of losing yourself in this other space that was made by the artist, and I guess I wanted to kind of traffic in what I would consider a modern, or what I would call a modern sublime, and I felt that drugs, initially I started using drugs, and initially I felt like they were probably the agents that were closest to a sense of the sublime that I had ever experienced in my life. I mean, when I speak of the sublime, I kind of refer to it in a kind of a Kantian way, in this idea that, you lose yourself, you can lose yourself in this sort of awe-inspiring place, but it can also be somewhat dangerous. You can lose so much of yourself that you disappear, and that can be sort of scary and dangerous. And it felt like those metaphors were really apt in drugs. And so, like, as I was referring to earlier, I mean, I wanted to make work that both could be experienced as pictures, but they could also be experienced as ideas of pictures. So you know, when I started archiving these things, these objects, I guess I saw them as these sort of like, I wanted to encapsulate them in these resin tamper-proof containers, so that they would sort of buzz in perpetuity forever with this sort of power, that they could be reused over and over again by different viewers, and but used through the eyes. And it was, I guess after that, you know, when I started using the leaves and the pills, once I started putting in photo collage, that really like opened things up. And I guess, you know, get back to your idea of like organization and archive. You know, I try to create these sort of systems where I sort of categorize everything according to genus, species, size, color, etc., into these flat files and drawers, and try to understand where they are, and then make pictures out of them.
It always just seemed, though, with my limited experience with collage or assemblage, that it's a very specific kind of relationship to the world, because in a way you are taking fragments of the world, of the rest of it, the collective, the already existing archive of culture, and making something new happen or making an event happen in that space, rather than dredging from the depths of your soul a purely, you know, unique image or unique gesture. I mean, there's obviously individuality there, but it's also something, an event that happens inside of a larger collective.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I really do think of myself increasingly as merely a conductor to this collectivist voices of culture and other writers, other artists, other photographers. Basically, they get to all sing through me. But really, there are all these individual voices. So in that regard, I mean, I really, but you know, to take that step a little further, I mean, all art really is predicated on the past. It's all built, it's all a palimpsest of histories, built on top of other histories. So no matter how, I don't know, how much of an individualistic person you think you are, you're still pulling, you know, from the history of all those things that came before. So, I mean, in a funny way, collage is just being very honest about the histories and honest about the collective nature of culture. So I really embrace this idea of the collectivity of culture in these various other writers and artists and even musicians that flow into my work. And I'm glad for them.
And then the whole move towards you know, shellacking these things in this resin, that comes out of your own Southern California past, doesn't it, in some ways?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, a lot of the aesthetics that outside of what I learned in art school come out of the California garage that I grew up in. You know, and you know, my garage was like, you know, we would shape boards and fiber, you know, glass them and use polyester resin. I mean, basically they were like little mini toxic waste areas, but they were happening all over Southern California. But you know, in that garage, I mean, there was all sorts of things and experiments going on. And to that, I have to really thank my parents for being so permissive, you know, because I had like little terrariums with snakes that I would catch, and you know, like a little zoo. I had like little, you know, I would, you know, be inventing different various things. Sometimes I almost blow the house up, you know. So there was always stuff going on in the garage, but that the resining is something I've been working with since I was about 12 years old. So I'm really conversant with the media, and I've been using it off and on throughout my entire career.
Yeah, it's a funny substance too, because it, you know, the whole fiberglass surfboard itself, it comes out of it's a material developed in the military during World War II. So it's there's this weird – there's so much weird karma in Southern California where there's there was so much military-based industry that started off during World War II, so much aerospace industry, so many products and things that came out of there. And then what you see is how some of them became kind of transformed by artists and people wanting to have a good time into these other sort of expressions, other cultural expressions. And, the surfboard very much, it's like this kind of iconic post-war object where it's an object of leisure, of exploration, of even fusion with nature, but at the same time its materials are toxic, like you say, and have this weird kind of legacy. But they also it also provides this wonderful sheen. So there's a kind of fetishistic pleasure to that sheen on your works, because there's like you sort of just the way that like a car shines or a beautiful cherished surfboard in totally perfect condition without any dings, there's this sort of sense of like almost a preserve, almost an object outside of decay in a way. I mean, there's a way in which you're kind of resisting decay of these plants, especially. I mean, by putting them under resin, aren't you kind of keeping them from doing their normal turning into dust?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, initially, my wanting to encapsulate them was a way in which to preserve them in perpetuity forever. These are all, water-soluble, ephemeral materials, and I wanted to sort of capture them, like bugs in amber, I guess you could say. So that was certainly one of the impetuses for it. And I mean, in a funny way, I think even, like, the sort of seductive quality of this sort of resin, there's almost a platonic ideal, I think, of, like, a seductive surface. Just happened to be almost a byproduct of this other desire I had to preserve these things forever. But I mean, in a funny way, it also, I think, really feels right for the kind of thing that I want my work to do. I mean, if these are vehicles to take you to other places or other dimensions or to get you into another place, I mean, what better metaphor than a surfboard or a car, as a vehicle to take you to another place. And there's one other thing that you said that's really fascinating to me, this idea that it came out of this sort of militaristic use. And I would argue that so much of what Southern California culture is about retooling the military. I mean, certainly, the computer revolution that emanated out of Silicon Valley was really, a kind of university military sort of industrial application that got loose and democratized and then turned into something else. And, I mean, even like even if you look at, like, say, the Hell's Angels, you're looking at a bunch of disaffected post-World War II bikers coming up out of San Bernardino and wanting to roar around the country. So, so many of these militaristic applications are just sort of like democratized, retooled, and turned into another kind of a thing, which is, it can almost be the history of another history of California.
Absolutely. No, that's super, super insightful. I wanted to ask you about the way you talk about what you hope your work can do, at least for some viewers, where you're quite open about that, your hope, your wish, your desire to inspire, trigger, some maybe unexpectedly, memories of altered states or just some kind of visionary experience or transport there in the gallery. And I'm curious whether, when I think about the New York art world, when I think about the discourse around art and the market around art, and I know that you've kept you're in there but not in there, but I, that seems to me like oh, it's such a naive thing. So naive to think that the art could actually like transport someone into this in this kind of visionary way. And I'm just, did you ever feel uncomfortable about that, or was it just like, this is what I want. This is what I hope people can experience and do experience through my work. I mean, you must be basing this partly on stuff people tell you, like, oh my God, that one painting was really intense.
Well, you know, it's been a funny thing. I mean, you know, I'm part of the art world, the official art world, but only barely, I think. I mean, I think that there's still like there is still some resistance in certain quarters for what I do. Some people maybe dismiss me. I've heard my, you know, I've heard everything, you know, but you know, some people dismiss me as like some brain dead hippie, you know, some guy, you know, people would rather that we trafficked in difficult images that are hard to look at and you know, things that go down, that don't go down very easily. And I think maybe part of whatever resistance I've found in the art world might have to do a bit with how my work goes down kind of easy at first glance, you know. But I mean, I do think that there's always these pathologies in the work. And I mean, there's always a virus or some sort of infected area in the work that is not entirely about this, you know, traveling to another dimension. There's always this other thing. There's always this doubt in the work, and you know, I guess it sort of teeters a little bit on the edge of all that. But I forgot what your question was. I'm sorry, Eric.
No, I was just wondering if you have any stories of people that people come up to you ever and just kind of go, yeah, man, I was just in a gallery in that. Or people might say that reminds them of things. And I mean, do you have a sense of how these...
Yeah, no, look, I mean, I think that there's this generational sort of zeitgeist sort of thing about, you know, that drugs and the sort of the shape of extra-dimensional experiences that may or may not be induced by drugs, that the work that I do are almost function in kind of like Proustian Madeleines, you know? They trigger sense memories, I think, in other people. Like, all of a sudden, like, I can, have a guy in my studio who's worth, like, $1 billion. Next thing I know, he's talking to me about, like, this acid trip that he had in, like, 1968. And, you know, and he's probably, it's really hilarious, you know, because I get the feeling that, like, I get to be the guy that a lot of people tell me their acid trips. And maybe they never ever do that. That doesn't seem to be part of their image that they're trying to present to the world. So I find that to be quite funny, you know. and it's always great to sort of know to see these people and to find out that they have this other history, and it sometimes comes up, you know, when people are checking out my work.
Yeah, I'm really interested in the kind of quote unquote visionary art world or the psychedelic art world, less because I love a lot of the art, because a lot of it to me is a little cliched and a little obvious, but it's actually more that it's sort of how it tries to function in that subculture, where it's people who are seeking visions that it's almost like a feedback loop where they're seeking visions that then they work really hard to incarnate, sometimes even from the inspiration of the experiences themselves. I've had some visionary artists tell me about how they figured out how to map some kind of weird three-dimensional pattern by like being shown it when they were high. And then they create these objects that then sort of feed back into other people's experience. Now, what you're doing to me is a lot more interesting than most of that because of these other elements we're talking about. There's a lot more valences to it. But there is definitely a sense of participating in the kinds of physiological and image level activity that produces these states. One image that's recent from your current show that really struck me is this, I think it's called Night Music for Raptors. They have an image of it on the New York Times review of the show, and it's this sort of owl creature made of eyes. Is that
yes.
The right? That one is just really intense because it has the overlapping sort of circular, radiating circles which is already a very kind of trance-inducing pattern that we, you know, see all over the place. Then you have these powerful eyes everywhere, which is such a signifier of these, like, visionary experiences. And it actually reminded me, not directly but indirectly, of one of my favorite Alex Gray paintings, which has kind of these radiating, overlapping mandalas of eyes. And it was really right. struck me because there's a way in which there's a similarity and the way in which you guys are doing very, very different kinds of things. But that particular image seemed, for me, particularly visionary. I don't know if it had a particular meaning for you, but I sure liked it.
Oh, thanks. Well, first of all, I'm friends with Alex, and I think the world of his work. I really, really think he's doing great things. The difference between me and Alex is that I don't really think of myself as a psychedelic artist in the way that I think Alex might think of himself that as a psychedelic artist. And I could be wrong, and I don't want to speak for him on this, but you know, I use this sort of psychedelic experience as a springboard to talk about other things. Sometimes they rest in the realm of the psychedelic, and sometimes they go outside of it. Whereas I think maybe, you know, a true psychedelic artist is really trying to bring back the experience from the other side of the dimensions, you know, as close to what they experienced as possible. But, you know, to talk about night music for raptors, I mean, the two concentric circles, where they meet are exactly the size of two LPs. And I tend to see this thing as like an aerial view of two turntables that are that also become an owl or become a raptor, and these little other concentric target circles are I tend to see as musical notations or the feathers of the owl or the stars of the night, you know. And so I'm trying to like I'm sort of trying to sort of talk about and kind of create a sense of synesthesia, and while also sort of adhering to the geometry that is at the core of these things, which are like the target-shaped bird's eyes that this is made out. It's thousands of little target-shaped bird's eyes that I've cut out of books that are then arranged in a target-like way that emanate and become a larger bird out of these little micro things. So out of these micro eyes, if that makes any sense at all.
It's so hard yeah, people to should check it out. It's a good description.
Visual.
It's a wonderful image.
What's that?
I said it's a wonderful image, and I think it was a good description. I did want to ask you on the more social critical tip. I don't think we've given quite enough play in this wonderful conversation to the inclusion of pharmaceutical drugs. Like that's one of the things that also really sets you apart from a psychedelic artist is that you're saying, yeah, there are these plants of vision which are themselves a little ambiguous and problematic. But also right there in the same painting, often the same piece, you'll have pharmaceutical drugs, and that whole world of like commodified, circulated, official psychopharmacology. What about that? What drew you to the pill as an image and an object
in
your work?
A pill is a sort of iconographic shape that comes out of the pharmaceutical industry. It's a hard, geometric, generally lozenge-shaped, oval-shaped, or circular shape, but it's a real hard geometry. And I initially started with those geometries that come out of corporate pharmaceutical culture, and then when I said, like earlier, when I was talking about putting the soft shape of nature in my work through the leaves, I developed this nice little, I think, tension between those things. But for me, you know, pharmaceutical culture, and the sort of drug subculture, there's a lot of similarities that I'm kind of interested in. I mean, I certainly grew up in a culture of better living through chemistry, and the impetus to take a pill whenever you weren't feeling well, or you know, to change your maybe say perception of pain into perception of pleasure, for instance, is not such a different. I don't think at its core, it's not the motivations for doing that and say maybe smoking a joint are not that dissimilar. So for me, I was like sort of maybe trying to find corollaries between official culture that says it's okay to take Prozac, say, because you're depressed, and it is obviously changing your perception and changing your reality, changing the structure of your mind, changing the serotonin uptake that's going on in your brain. And but it's not okay to take acid, but yet acid is also a serotonin modifying drug that is not a drug we're supposed to take. But I do think that there's some corollaries and some similarities there. So I'm really interested in kind of putting those things together.
Well, it's fascinating because you really see, right, when you start to look at those issues, how much of a construct the idea of drugs even are. You know, like, what is a drug? Is it the illegal drugs? Is it, what does it mean to even call something a drug as opposed to a substance or a pharmaceutical or a entheogen? And like, even our language around these things, suggests how much a moving target it is. And it is moving. I mean, can you believe it? Can you believe Prop 19 in California? I mean, just the existence of it just blows the mind.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's about time, for crying out loud. And, that drug, if it's going to get legalized, is going to be probably one of the safer drugs on the pike. When you think about some of the poison that's being released officially and sanctioned by the pharmaceutical industry and by, you know, the government, it drives me crazy that it's taken so long. But let's hope it passes.
Yeah. How do you see Can you sense some changes in the whatever general zeitgeist based on how people react to your work? I mean, when you're like reading reviews, or do you sense a kind of shift in terms of people going like, you know, we got to take these things a little more seriously. We got to look at a wider range and not just put it in the same old, you know, boxes.
Are you talking about my work now and how?
Yeah,
it's
yeah. When people like, if people, you know, when you read reviews or people are responding to it, do you get a sense of people changing their attitudes towards drugs, towards visionary compounds?
I don't know. I don't know. I think it's really hard to generalize about it. I mean, you know, there are a lot of different people that like my work for different reasons. I just can't keep up with like all the variegations of it. I guess as long as people are getting something out of it, I'm okay with it. I mean, if people want to experience my work purely as a visual, visionary feast for the eyes and just groove on it on that level, maybe even think of myself as a psychedelic artist, that's fine. But, and, you know, there are other people that can't give themselves permission to like my work on that level. And they need to get into the text behind the work in order to, allow themselves to jump off into this place that would normally maybe be a little off limits or a little icky to them. And that's okay too. I mean, for me, you know, the formal qualities of the work, the sort of seductive quality of the work, it is a lot like a pop song in that there's a melody, a rhythm, and it's seductive, and it comes through the body, and it comes through the senses. And then the text behind the work, the things I'm thinking about, they're more or less like they're more or less the lyrics to the song, and almost everybody listens to the lyrics second. I mean, you gotta like the song first, right? So
yeah.
For me, it's just about making songs, visual songs, and just, you know, throwing in a few hooks and trying to be true to to what I want to hear, what I want to see, and then, you know, and being mindful, I think, maybe of the sort of collective sort of social parameters that bracket it, and then hoping that other people may be able to figure out a way into the work based on a shared history. And that's all I can hope for, you know, and people are going to like or dislike it for whatever reasons, and I can't control it or
nor do I want to.
Yeah, that's wonderfully said. I think that's a great reflection on the work and how it itself is kind of an invitation that's friendly in some ways and kind of scary in some other ways, and that ambiguity I think is very powerful. It actually reminded me of one other kind of genre or whatever that you've done that we didn't talk about, which is these tweaked New York Times newspaper covers, where the image, the main image, is exploding with these psychedelic intensity, but it's often coupled with these sort of monstrous characters, you know, the CEO of WorldCom and the Madoff and all that, and that's really like in a way like captures that ambiguity, because it's like it's the real world, it's the New York Times, it's another scandal, it's some money thing, and yet there's still this explosion that's kind of beautiful and kind of sublime and kind of scary at the same time. You know, it's great. Those are great pieces.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no, I mean, those are for me, they're really quick. I mean, I can take 3 to 6 months sometimes to make a picture in my studio, so for me to do it in a few days in the Times is just a very direct way of kind of dealing with the world and maybe dealing with some of the frustrations I have with it. And, you know, I can riff any way I want. I mean, I can go off on what's going on in the news and play off of that, or I can just play with the image formally, you know.
Yeah.
Hey,
we got to wrap it up. Sorry about cutting you off.
Sure.
This is Eric Davis. You've been listening to Expanding Mind with Fred Tomaselli today. And if you're in the Brooklyn area, check out his work at the Brooklyn Museum. Thanks, Fred.
Thanks, Eric. It's been really great.